All right, we are recording. This is Jen Brown. I'm in San Marcos, Texas. It's April 22nd, 2022. And I'm here with Ed Bradley. And also present is his wife, Sue. and we are here today to do an oral history and talk about his work as a biologist with Texas Parks and Wildlife. So to begin, do I have your permission to record?
Sure.
Okay, thanks.
Yes.
Can we start by you telling us about your background in early life?
Well, my mother was born in Norway, a little town on Sognefjord, the largest fjord in Norway. And when she graduated from high school, she got angry with the family. Apparently, from what she told me, some guy, one of the members of the family, had built up this huge fishing fleet, and then he passed, and she thought one of the girls would have done a better job of running it, but no, they gave it to one of the guys, and she said he ran it into the ground. And so that made her mad, and she and a friend of hers got on a ship and sailed to London. Or sailed to England, and her friend got homesick and got on a ship and went back to Norway, but my mother got on another ship and sailed to Canada, and she never went back. And in Canada, she met the man who became my father, and he worked with racehorses. In fact, on my birth certificate for his occupation, it just says racehorse man. And I guess they traveled all around the country to different tracks, you know, following the races. And I think at one time he was had worked with horses as a trainer, maybe. Anyway, when she found out she was pregnant, she said she wanted me to be born in the prettiest town they had been in, and that was Hot Springs, Arkansas, where they have a big racetrack, Oaklawn Park. So that's what they did. They moved to Hot Springs, and I was born. And they divorced when I was less than a year old, and I never knew what he looked like, never saw a picture of him or anything. I never knew what happened to him. That's all I knew. So then my mother worked from the time I've known her, she worked as a waitress. And we moved around several places. Especially in the summer, she would go to where she thought work was better. And at one point, we got on a bus, and I thought we were going to Houston. Turns out it didn't say Houston, it said Austin. So we went to and lived in Austin for that summer, and then she met some friends and were telling her about Corpus Christi. And so when I was in the fourth grade, I went to grade school in Corpus Christi, and that's where I grew up, and that's where I went to college. And back then, it was University of Corpus Christi. And I got interested in marine biology with a counselor at the high school. She was great, and she and I got along real well, and she gave me some pamphlets and information about marine biology because of the tests that I had taken. I was real good in two things, they said, writing and outdoors. And so that's what led her to kind of push me towards marine biology. And so I attended University of Corpus Christi, and my professor was Dr. Henry Hildebrand. And he was a great guy. Everybody liked him. But he's a little off, a little weird, and he would get in fights with other doctors that wanted. I think he had the biggest battle with Gordon Gunter. They were always battling about one thing or another. Anyway, so our classes weren't that big. We maybe six or eight in a class, and he would take us out in his Jeep. Frequently, we'd go to the beach, and one day we were driving along Padre Island towards Port Aransas, and we saw this big fish in the not very far out, maybe 20 yards out into the surf, and he was floundering around. So we stopped and looked at him for a minute, and somebody said, well, let's get him, let's drag him in. So we had a rope there. So another fellow and myself grabbed that rope and ran out there and were wrapping that rope around his tail, and he was floundering around, and so we couldn't get a good grip on him with that rope. And finally I said, grab him by the tail and let's run. And that's what we did. We grabbed him by the tail and ran him right up on the beach. And it was a broad-billed swordfish. And so we ended up putting him in the back of the Jeep and went on to Port Aransas. And somewhere there's a picture of our class with him where they weighed and measured all the fish. And he was hanging up, and there's a picture of him hanging up and the class standing there. I've got it somewhere. I don't know where it is. But then Dr. Hildebrand took that fish back to the university, and he said he was going to debone it, get it all down just to the skeleton. And if he did, I don't know. I never talked to him about it, never asked him about it, but I have wondered occasionally if something happened to it, or what happened to it, where it is. But anyway, we caught it with our bare hands. We figured it must have been sick or something wrong with it, obviously. But anyway, that's what happened while I was in school. Now, during my junior year, I had applied to the Texas Game and Fish Commission, because they had what they call summer assistance. And I had Dr. Hildebrand gave me this idea and said I should. So I did. And sure enough, I remember vividly walking out to the mailbox one day, and there was a letter from them, and I had been accepted, which I thought was great. And there were maybe eight of us summer assistants from different universities that worked there all that summer. And the first thing I remember is they had opened Cedar Bayou. I don't know if you're familiar with it. Anyway, it had been closed, and they got it open. And so we took a houseboat and a couple of other boats out there to try to catch and see if fish were coming through the bayou. And the time we left, it was night. It was dark already. And behind us, there was the little single-celled creatures with photophores that lit up. And as the boat's propellers turned up the water, they just all lit up. And I had never seen anything like that in my life. I'll never forget that. I thought, wow, this is something. And
did it look like?
It looked like fireworks in the water, except you didn't have the big ones, but they were just everywhere the propeller made a little wake. It just lit up. It was like going through a, I don't know what it's like going through, but it'd be like sparks from fire. And it was fantastic. I had never seen anything like that. It was amazing. Anyway, we finally got to where we were, and we put out nets. And then some of the guys who liked to do it, I'd never seen this before either, but they went wading out there and gigging. I don't know if you've ever seen anybody do that, but they carry a lantern with them, and so they can see. And the water was real clear, and they were gigging big redfish and flounder. And so apparently the Cedar Bayou had been working real well. And anyway, we put up a net, and the next morning we pulled a big cow nose ray out of it. It must have been this wide. And there's somewhere I also have a picture of me and a summer assistant from the University of Texas. He's holding one of the wings out, and a full-time biologist from Michigan State is holding the other wings out, and they're hamming for the camera, you know. They're looking at the camera and smiling. Me, I'm holding the tail. I'm holding it up. My head is down because I'm straining to get that thing up off the ground. Anyway, that
this
was
about 5 feet. Or
yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. It was way cooler. Here I was doing stuff and seeing stuff that was amazing to me. I'd never, the old country boy, I'd never seen anything like that.
When you grew up in Corpus Christi, did you grow up fishing and hunting?
I did a little fishing, but not much. I was telling Sue the other day when we were down there, we lived at one time just off Port Avenue. And one of the guys that I hung out with, we'd get up early in the morning periodically and go walk down to the bayfront and fish, and we never caught anything, you know. I was not totally impressed by that. But there was one time, another time when I was still in the fourth grade, we went down to the T-head, and there was a guy fishing there, and he caught a great big black drum. And he didn't want it, so he gave it to us. And we told everybody we caught it. But we ended up selling it to a restaurant, which I don't know what put that in our head, but we did. We went to, took it to the restaurant and said, "Would you want to buy this?" And they bought it from us. Excuse me. But anyway, that was another little experience. So, where am I? Oh. So, we spent that as a summer assistant. You know, one of the boat operators that they had called us summer idiots. And he was probably pretty close to right. But anyway, we spent that summer doing all the different things out in the... I was telling Sue we were looking at jellyfish at the aquarium. And there's one Aurelia arita jellyfish. And I was out in the bay and got stung in the armpit by one. It hurt, but it wasn't real serious, but... We did a lot. I spent a lot of time in the water. I don't know how, but I was always the one in the water. And I guess I enjoyed it. I'm sure I did. Anyway, when the summer was over, everybody went back to their schools. And they kept me on the payroll, working part-time. And I would pick up samples of... things, a big jar full of samples that needed identifying and counted, and I'd take that back to UCC with me, and then I'd spend the week examining it in the lab, and then first day of the next week I'd take that back and get another jar, and I did that for the rest of that year. They kept me on part-time, and when I graduated at the end of my senior year, I had a full-time job already with them. So I went from summer assistant to part-time to full-time. And that was plan B. Plan A was there was a guy from the Valley who did underwater photography for Walt Disney. And he had put in for a grant to go to the Bahamas and study and photograph gobies. And what all they did. If he gets that grant, I go with him. That's plan A. He didn't get the grant. So I went with plan B, Parks and Wildlife. And that worked out great. So Anyway, there we are. I'm now with Parks and Wildlife. And I had seen Henry Compton while I was still at university because he was like a year and a half ahead of me. But, of course, I saw him at the lab all the time. That's the only place I ever saw him was at the lab, but I saw him there quite a bit. So when I went to the Parks and Wildlife, there he was. He was already there, been there maybe a year or more. And so we saw him some during the summer. He worked with some of us, and we did some things for him. But when I went full-time, I worked with him, and he and I worked the Gulf. But at that time, all we had was a 42-foot bay shrimp boat, wooden hull. And so we couldn't spend the night out in the Gulf. We'd go during the day, and you couldn't go too far out. But we went out there and took trawl samples and that kind of thing and did the best we could. Well, one time, we were working off Port Mansfield. You know where Port Mansfield is? Okay. Yeah. We were working out of there. And normally what we would do is the deckhand and the boat operator would run the boat to wherever we were going down the Intracoastal, and Hank and I would drive. So we met them at Port Aransas, and on this occasion, Dr. Hildebrand brought a class to go out with us. That happened fairly often. And so we were out in the Gulf trawling and to show this class, you know, what we needed to, what they wanted to see. And the transmission went out on the boat. So we put the anchor out and we were stuck. We called the Coast Guard and told them where we were. And this was about noon. And then we flagged down, there was a fishing boat passing nearby, and we flagged it down and got Hildebrand and all the class people onto the fishing boat so they could take them back to Port Mansfield. Well, and then we sat there, the four of us, on this boat. The Coast Guard got there at midnight, and we told them where we wanted to go, and they hooked up to us and started hauling us, and they almost pulled the rig off the front. They were pulling so hard, we had to honk the horn and tell them to slow down. And when we got to Port Mansfield, we were waving, and they just went right past Port Mansfield, and they took us to Port Isabel, because that's where their headquarters was. Well, they got us there, and sure enough, the transmission was out. But also, they found, I don't know how many discrepancies safety-wise on that boat. And the sheriff came out the next morning. I can still remember him standing there with his hand on his gun, you know, like we thought maybe we were drug peddlers or something. And he said, well, who are you with? And we said, well, we're right there. It's with the, and by that time, it was the Parks and Wildlife. We had the sticker on the boat. And he said, well, anybody can put a sticker on a boat. So we hooked him up with Austin, had him call Austin, verify who we were. And so we were there about a week. And finally, we got the boat fixed, and we could send it back up the Intracoastal. And Hank and I drove in his car back. But before we left, the guys with the Coast Guard gave us a great big paper bag full of grilled cheese sandwiches. I don't know why they did that, but they saw good things in us or something. But Hank hated grilled cheese sandwiches, so I just pigged out on grilled cheese sandwiches all the way home. So, but it was that incident that made everybody think, maybe we need a new boat. Maybe we need something better to work if we're going to work out in the Gulf. And that's how we did it, or that's how it got started. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service went in with us 50-50. The Parks and Wildlife paid for half, and they paid for half. So there in Rockport, there was a shipbuilding company, and they built us a shrimp boat, 72-foot steel hull. And instead of having an ice hole down below, we had a lab and a couple of bunks to sleep in. So it worked great, and we used that boat for quite a few things. We took college kids always wanted to go out with us, and their professors wanted to go out with us. So we did a lot of shrimp studies, trawling for shrimp, seeing what the commercial people were catching. And we worked the whole coast. Back in that time, which is the 1960s, we were among the first to do a lot of things. One thing I recall, you know the Flower Garden Reef off of Galveston. Well, everybody knew about it, but nobody knew much about it. So we got a deal with the U.S. Navy, and we drove up to, Hank and I drove up to Galveston, and the Navy sent a cruiser and picked us up in Galveston, went out to Flower Garden Reef, and we anchored up and spent two nights out there. And Navy divers would go down to the reef, catch fish, bring them back up, and Hank and I had our fish books, and we identified the fish that were down there. That was what we did. We just spent 2 days doing that, and then they took us back to Galveston after that. But that was interesting because I don't know that anybody had ever dived on that reef before. But it was interesting to see the fish that were there of all kinds. I don't know who, we had the list, and I'm sure the Navy had the list and got around. But that was interesting. That was a kind of a first. And there was another time when we were Fish and Wildlife Service was interested in sea turtles and trying to, you know, still are trying to propagate sea turtles. So one day they brought a tub full of baby sea turtles to the lab there in Rockport, and we took them out, and nobody knew anything at that time. For as far as I know, maybe the first time it was tried, but we went out to the Gulf and released those sea turtles. Well, we know now that's not the way to do it. They got to come off the beach. They didn't know where, they never grew up knowing where they're supposed to be. But we learn, we live and we learn. And so that was another thing we did. One time, we took the boat, the Western Gulf is what we call it. We took it back to Galveston. The Fish and Wildlife Service had a lab there. I don't know if they still do or not, but back then they did. And about four or five of the biologists from that lab got on the boat with us, and we went out off of Galveston, and we spent 30 days out there. And what we did was, we'd work all night and sleep all day, but at night we would trawl for brown shrimp, and we had a live tank on the back of the boat, and we'd catch these brown shrimp and put them in that tank. And then at a certain point, these Fish and Wildlife guys would stain the shrimp. They'd inject a green dye into the shrimp, and they had done some work to make sure it didn't hurt the shrimp. They were prepared too. And so then we'd release these stained shrimp. And the idea was, they put posters up all over Texas, Louisiana. And I think they offered like $5. If you caught one of these, you could turn it in and get $5. We just wanted to know where you caught it so we could trace migratory patterns. So we did that for 30 days. And it was kind of fun, a lot of fun. I remember one morning we anchored up, and the deckhand we had could cook. Oh, man, he was great. And he'd fix breakfast. Everybody kind of had to fix their own after that, but he fixed breakfast. So I got my tray and my coffee, and I went out on the deck, and it was beautiful. Sun just come up. It was beautiful. The water was crystal smooth and clear. And the side of the deck was about that wide, maybe a foot, foot and a half. So I sat myself down, straddled that, put my tray down and my coffee, and I was thoroughly enjoying myself. Man, this is great. Drinking coffee and eating my breakfast. And a little family of bottlenose dolphins came up. It was two adults and one little one. And they came up and they looked up at me, and I looked down at them, and I'll be darned, it was just like going to Cyorama. They started jumping out of the water and down. All three of them did that for a little while. I don't know if they thought I was going to feed them something or what. But after a while, they got tired of messing with me and they left. But while that was all happening, I can remember looking at my food and looking at them and thinking, it just doesn't get any better than this, does it? That was fantastic. And let's see, what else?
What year did the boat, first boat, break down? And
oh, that was, well, it was about 65, somewhere around in there, about 1965.
And you start, that's when you, the year you started full-time?
No, I was full-time 63.
Okay.
But we had worked for a couple of years in the Gulf with that boat, just doing the best we could with it.
What did Hildebrand and his students do when it broke down?
What did they do?
Yeah.
It wasn't anything they could do. Everybody just stood around for a while. And, excuse me. And then we got them off. They were glad to get off. And truthfully, I was glad to get them off. That was less we had to worry about. Just ourselves, we were okay. So, but on the Western Gulf, we took class after class after class. And we went out a lot. I don't know if we were, in this day and age, I think all you can go is 9 miles. We went a lot farther than that. And we would trawl and bring up some of the fish that Hank has painted, the real weird, fierce-looking fish. But the truth is, they're all little bitty things. And they live in the pressure, so when you bring them up, they're dead when you get them up there. But I did a lot of lecturing to college classes that came to the lab. I enjoyed that, but I always at some point in my lecture, I don't know if they still have them or not, but we had those fish in jars, and I'd hold them up and let them look at them and stuff, and so they'd get an idea. Yeah, they're fierce looking, but they're pretty small.
And so these deep sea trawls, you just bring them up and identify them and bring them back to the lab.
And we were kind of trying to see what was there. And in addition to, of course, we were studying the shrimp populations. But we were also trying to see what else was out there. We didn't have any idea that they were going to have a limit on how far you could go. or half or a week ago. So we went out and did some fun stuff. It was a lot of fun. And then at some point I left the Parks and Wildlife and taught in junior high for 2 years. And then I decided that I wanted to go back to the Parks and Wildlife. And Hank had left at that time. And so when I called them, they said, yeah, we'll put you in charge of the Western Gulf. You'll be the guy in charge. Hank had been in charge before. So that's what we did. I came back and I was in charge of the Western Gulf. And not too long after that, C.E. Bryan came and he worked with me on the Western Gulf. And so we kept on taking people out and doing different things. But I remember, have you been to the lab in Rockport?
No, I haven't.
Well, they have a library upstairs. I'm going to scoot just a little bit.
Yeah.
And I don't want to mess
you. Do you want to take a break? Or
no, I'm fine. They have a library upstairs, and one of the books I found was called The Sea of Cortez by John Steinbeck and Ed Ricketts. I know you know who John Steinbeck is, but Ed Ricketts was a PhD marine biologist. And did you ever read Cannery Row?
Yeah.
Okay, well, you know, there's a character in there called Doc. And Doc is a marine biologist, and he catches species in the tide pools and sells them to universities and labs and stuff. Well, that character was based on Ed Ricketts. He was a PhD. And one time, the two of them, I'm sure they spent a lot of time drinking and having fun together, but they got an idea to do some research, marine biology research. So they got a hold of a ship they could use. They got it all loaded up with their equipment, and they sailed around the Baja Peninsula up in that body of water between the Baja Peninsula and Mexico is called the Sea of Cortez. I don't know if it still is, but it was then. And so they decided that they were going to try to find out kind of what we were doing, what's there, and how many do we think are there. And so they did a lot of netting and all kinds of stuff. And I know that the results of their work has been utilized by others who came along after and compared what we're catching now with what they caught then, you know. And so I thought about that. I read that book two or three times. And I thought about that, and I thought, why don't we do something like that, but just with one species? So we decided it was going to be the red snapper, Lugenus campechanus. And I think that's correct. And so I talked to several people about ways to go about this. And I even drove to Port Aransas. I think Gordon Gunner was the head of the lab, the UT lab there for a while. And I talked to him and he gave me some ideas. And so we developed a program where we would on our boat, we would shrimp like we had been doing the shrimp studies because we knew there were littler red snapper that we would catch. And this would give us an idea. We could compare how many we were catching and where we were catching them. And then we would also go and anchor up on reefs that we were all up and down the coast. And we fished for red snapper just like commercial fishermen did. We'd have a big anchor weight and go down there and have four, five, six hooks going at the same time. And then we'd bring them up, weigh, measure, and get all that information. Then CE mainly would go to around to the various fish houses where the commercial fishermen were bringing red snapper in. And he would weigh and measure the commercial catch. Excuse me. I'm not used to talking this much.
Do you need a break?
No, but I'm just have to cough every once in a while.
That's okay.
And once a month, I drove from Rockport up to Galveston. And I made a deal with one of the party boats, and I used the same party boat every time. But I would go out with them and weigh and measure what the party people were catching. So that worked great. And I don't know how many times I went every month for 3 years. And I never went out a time that they didn't get up a poll or some kind of bet going on among the fishermen who would catch the biggest one. And I was never there because they knew what I was up to. And there was never a time when somebody didn't say, well, let's let the government man decide which is the biggest one. So they made it easy on me. They'd bring their red snapper to me to weigh and measure. So that was a lot of fun. And so anyway, at the end of the 3 years, we wrote a paper for the Proceedings of the Gulf and Caribbean Fisheries Association, and C.E. presented that paper. I forget where he went, Miami or somewhere, and he presented that paper, and it's there. It's on the internet somewhere. But one of the things that we decided, or we didn't decide, but we stated, was that while you were shrimping, all these shrimpers out there, they're killing the little red snapper. The red snapper are near shore, and as they get older, they gradually work back out to deeper water. And so we said that there needs to be something done at certain times of the year to help protect those little red snapper. And so they did. They used our report to shut down the shrimping industry in certain areas at certain times. Of course, the shrimpers got mad at us, but that's nothing new. They always get mad at us.
Oh, yeah?
Well, because Parks and Wildlife makes the laws, and they have to live by them. They made them put some kind of net in their trawl so that it protected the turtles, sea turtles, if they caught them. And they didn't like that too much, but they had to do it. Anyway, so we got that done. And by that time, after that report came out, I was not working on the Western Gulf anymore. C.E. was, and he got another assistant to help him. And I was working in the bays. And I worked with Ed Hagen then. Did you know Ed Hagen? Okay. Anyway. So one time, we drove up to near Sea Drift. I forget which bay that is. Matagorda Bay, maybe? Anyway, we were up there, and we were pulling a shrimp net in the bay. And there was a stingray caught in the net, in the webbing. Well, I saw him down there. And I reached out to grab the webbing and pull it away from him. But what I didn't see was that his spine was hooked in the webbing and sticking straight up. And when I went down with my right hand to grab that net, I ran that deal right through my finger, his spine right through my finger. And of course, what did I do? I jerked, ran it back through again. But anyway, they were all saying, well, we need to get you back. I said, oh, you know, I'm a tough guy. said, no, I just put a little, we had some of this freeze stuff, and I put some freeze stuff on that. And that lasted about 30 minutes, and I said, boys, we need to get back. So they took me back, and from there, from Sea Drift, we called my doctor and told him, don't leave. I'm coming in, so don't leave. So I sat in the back seat, and they drove as fast as they could to get me back to Rockport. And my arm, I remember clearly thinking while we were in the back seat, I remember thinking, you know, if we just cut my arm off at the shoulder, that would feel a lot better. That would be the way to fix this problem. Just cut my arm off at the shoulder. Well, we got to the doctor's office. He took me in, sat me down, and he had a needle of Novocaine. And he just, I'll never forget this either. My hand's shaking a little bit because I have Parkinson's. Anyway, he was standing there and I was sitting down. He took my hand, injected the Novocaine a couple of spots in my finger, and he put the needle down. He just stood there, folded his arms, and looked at me with this big smile on his face. And I thought, what the hell are you smiling at? But then it hit me when the Novocaine hit. But it was like stepping into a shower. It started at the very top of my head, and it was just like water, cool water coming down. And it finally went down to my whole body. And I won't forget that either. That was an experience. But it worked. And then he gave me some medication and sent me home. And I never had any more trouble with that. But that was the worst pain that I had ever had. The second worst pain was a sea urchin I got in my knee. Hank and I... They have at the lab there in Rockport, they have a little aquarium. I don't know if they still do, but they used to have a little aquarium. And during the summer, Hank and I would get we'd go to Whataburger or someplace and get one of these big wide mouth gallon jars and clean it up. And we'd take it to Port Aransas at the jetties. And I don't know if you know, but at Port Aransas, the water is crystal clear during the summer. It comes in right in the little jetties. And you go down there and there's little tropical fish, beautiful, just like you see in an aquarium. So we'd go in there and get a sea urchin and bust him open, and his eggs were bright yellow. And those fish love that. So we'd put the eggs in the wide mouth gallon jar and then just lay it down, and these little fish would just swim in there and then all you had to do was tilt it up, because they never swim up to get out. They always try to get out swimming down. I don't know why, but that's the way they are. And so we would have a lot of fun going over there once in a while and catching tropical fish and bringing them back, beautiful fish, to the aquarium. That was another little adventure we had. I don't know if I should tell you about the explosive or not.
Yes, now you have to.
Well, when I was in the chemistry lab, UCC, we learned how to make, I can't remember the name of it, but it's an explosive that you filter it out. It's on filter paper. It's wet. Harmless, but once it dries, any little thing and it'll explode, so you don't want to have too much of it. Well, one of the things I did while I was still in school was I went up to the lab and made some by myself, and I brought it down to the student center, and I walked around and just scattered it all over the floor, And then I went and got me something to drink and just sat down and watched. And people, and of course, it was just little drops here and there. So people would pow, step on it, and pow, pow, pow. That was a lot of fun. I had a good time with that. And you may be the first person I've told that I did that.
Did you? No one knew it was you? You
didn't? No, absolutely not. I was sitting over there drinking a Coke. I was just watching. Nobody had a clue. What, they didn't know what it was or what was happening. But anyway, that was fun. But I made the mistake of telling Hank about this stuff. Oh, I did tell him. And so we decided, we went out to his house, and we made a batch up. Took it back to the lab and put it in a guy's stapler. So you can imagine the first time that he hit the stapler. We didn't put enough to do any real damage, but that was a lot of fun too. Hank and I had a lot of fun together. I don't know why. He was a little bit older than me, and I don't know why we got along so well, but we did. When we were going back a little bit, am I talking too much?
No.
Okay, well, going back a little bit, turns out that the fellow from University of Texas who was in the picture with the cow nose ray, he and I were roommates. He and I stayed in Rockport. I don't know where everybody else went. But the first night, we didn't have a place to stay. So the first night that we were there, we slept on the houseboat that was back in Rockport. Well, Hank said he had to go do some work one night, and we could sleep at his place. All he asked is that we feed, somebody had some Black Angus cattle on his land. He had like 20 acres and an old dilapidated house, old dilapidated. So we said, okay, that's what we'll do. And he told us where the cow feed was. And we drove out there, and then there was a little shed in the back. And the time of day wasn't total dark, but it wasn't any sun either. You know how it is, all you see is black and white, you know, just outlines. So we went to the shed in the back, and I opened the door and I stepped in because he had told us where the feed was. And I heard this gurgling sound, and I looked around, and all I saw was his feet disappearing from the door. From the side of the door. And I looked down, and a snake was coiling up right outside the door. So I looked at that snake, and I waited a minute, and finally it crawled under the shed. So then I went out, and this poor guy was laying across the hood of the car, and he was going, "Oh my God, oh my God." And what had happened was the snake had fallen off of the roof and hit him on the head and slid down his body. Well, that would have scared anybody. And so I told him, I said, we still got to feed those cows. So I did. I went back in there and got the feed. And he followed me when I walked down to where the cows were. He followed me in the car with the lights on. So we fed the cows. And then we decided we'd go back and sleep on the houseboat again. We didn't want any part of the Hank's house anymore.
What was Hank like?
He was a little taller than me, slender, very smart. One of the smartest people I've ever been around. In the Korean conflict, he flew the F-86 Sabre jet. And I think he got shot down one time, although he never was captured. But he told me that he had had to parachute out one time. while he was in the military, he met and fell in love with a nurse who was also in the military. And they were going to get married. And at some point in time, she was in a plane that crashed in Alaska, and she was killed. And he told me, physically, literally, he put his fist in the air and cursed God. And he never got over that. Never. But he was a great guy. Had a great sense of humor. He and I don't know, maybe I was like a burr in his blanket. I don't know. But we got along great. I slept with him in his bed I don't know how many times. And you could hear the rat, the snakes catching mice in the walls. You could hear the mice screaming in the walls. But that's the way it was. And Hank and I traveled a lot together. Because when we go to the valley to work, we didn't ride the boat, we drive down. I remember one time we were in Matamoros across from Brownsville, and we had eaten at a restaurant we liked, and we were walking down the street, and here was a, I don't know what you call it, a store with big glass of windows, and we looked in there, and there were two pair of boxing gloves. And we looked at each other, and we had to have those boxing gloves. So we went in, and we each got us a pair of boxing gloves. And we were staying in Port Isabel at the time, in a motel that had stone walls, and they weren't smooth. They were, stones would stick out. So, of course, we boxed in the motel room. And I don't know how it worked, but every time he hit me, he would knock me against the wall, the rock wall. Every time I hit him, he'd fall on the bed. I never figured that out. But when we got back to Rockport at his place, we decided we wanted to keep this going. So we built a ring in his backyard, 4x4s, put a rope around it. And then we'd have a kitchen timer set for 3 minutes, 3 minute rounds. We'd put that on one of the 4x4s, and we'd box for till the kitchen timer went off and take a break and then box some more. And you know, that boxing is hard. It's hard to keep your arms up when you're not in shape and do that. But we even put a speed bag in his house so you could boodle, boodle, boodle. We got carried away there with that boxing for a while. And he had a problem similar to something I have. His shoulder would go out, especially when he'd throw a big right hook at me. His shoulder would go out, and we'd have to stop, and I would grab his shoulder and yank it back into position, and we'd go again. And I didn't realize at the time how much that hurt, but I know now how much it hurts because I've had that similar happen to me. But he was a great guy, and he tried to be such a gentleman. If you were to come over to his house, there might be the chair you're sitting in might have leaves on it. But he would, before you sat down, he would sweep the leaves off the chair and try to make you as comfortable as possible. And he had a brother, Bill, younger brother, Bill. We called him Brother Bill. Duh. And sometimes we'd go over to Brother Bill's house, which was there in Rockport. And Brother Bill had a great Martin guitar, really good guitar. And he played guitar, I played guitar, and usually there'd be somebody else there that played guitar, and then there'd be Hank. And usually, on average, it was four of us. They would pass this guitar around, and one guy would play and sing some whatever, a song he'd written or something, a song he liked, and then pass it to the next guy. And then they pass it to Hank. Well, he couldn't play the guitar, and he couldn't sing. So he passed it to the next guy. Well, that made Hank mad. So he got a tape recorder, and he recorded a bunch of songs he liked. So when it was his turn, he'd push the button, and we had to sit there and listen to that song that he'd recorded, get his turn out of the way. But those were some wild days. One of the guys that came, this was while, some of it was while I was still in school. One of the guys that came, I was in school with, and at some point he tried to talk me into going to California with him to be in the music business in California. And I said, no, for many reasons, I can't do that. So he went and became part of the New Christy Minstrels. I don't know if you ever heard of them, but that was Kenny Rogers first sang with them. Now, he was in that group for a while anyway. But we had a lot of fun over at Brother Bill's house and at Hank's house. I remember, am I telling you too much?
No, go ahead.
I remember we had a lot of parties, and Parks and Wildlife employees had a lot of parties. And I was one of the few that didn't drink beer. I didn't drink anything back then. And but I had a four-string banjo, and everybody loved that four-string banjo. And I'd play, and everybody would sing. And it's amazing, the later the night got and the drunker everybody got, the more religious music they wanted. I don't know how that works. But I remember one time, a guy that worked at the lab, he was singing about as far from me as you are. And then he walks right up to me, and he's singing some soulful song. And I look down at his hand, he's holding a long neck bottle of beer upside down. He's pouring beer all over my feet while he's singing soulfully to me. And but we had a fellow from India, one of the Sikhs, that I think that's what you had. And he was a summer assistant, but they didn't cut their hair, they didn't cut their beard or anything. And every morning he'd get up and twirl his beard around his head and then put something over that. But he was a great guy. His name was, can I say his name or no?
Yeah.
Jagdeep Singh, but everybody called him Juggy. And he cooked a meal for everybody at somebody's house one time. And it was great, but it was hot. Oh, man, he liked to burn our throats out, but it sure was good. So.
Did you know that Hank painted?
Yes. In fact, he did the drawings for a couple of the books that are pamphlets of the fish that are on the Texas coast. He did those drawings as well, and he showed me how you do it. And I started a big eye, Preacanthus elatus, I think, and I was doing it well, but I didn't have enough patience. It takes a lot of patience to do it that way. And apparently he had more patience than I gave him credit for. But it's after he was out of the Parks and Wildlife and I was out of the Parks and Wildlife, I saw him at Helen's house one time, his brother Bill's wife. And he had put some paintings in one of the art exhibits, art shows there, and to sell. I don't know how he did on that, but I was telling him, if I ever bought anything from you, I would want a picture of these fish we used to catch, the deep sea fish that are fierce looking. Turns out he started painting those, and he painted quite a few of them. But I remember when we were both still in Rockport one time, Rockport had a art fair every year, big deal. And I told him, I said, why don't you, because people have booths and stuff, I said, why don't you put your paintings up at the art fair? Nah, I wouldn't do that. Why? Because I don't want anybody to know who I am. I said, well, just paint a picture of a paper bag with eye holes in it, and you can be the unknown artist. And I said, you won't even have to do it. I'll sit out there, and I'll sell them for you. No, he wouldn't go. He wouldn't have anything to do with that. He was somehow too good for that. I think I told you how smart he was. One of his favorite things to do was crossword puzzles. And he would get two of them the same, and he would want to bet you who could finish it first. We'd both put up $5 and go, and who could finish it first. The last time I saw him, or one of the last times, he said that the crosswords had gotten so easy that he would take scissors and cut either the up and down or the sideways away. So all you had was the one to go by because the crosswords were so easy for him. Isn't that amazing? Sue met him one time. He was working at the Oso Pier then. And so I wanted Sue to meet him. So we went over there and visited with him for a little while. That was the last time I saw him.
When was that?
When was that?
In the 1990s, because we were dating.
Yeah. 1990s, I guess. I don't remember exactly when he died. But anyway. But he was a great guy. And I thought the world of him. He was a crude guy. And he drank a lot. And I think that related back to him losing his fiancée. He just never got over it. But you know, he and I drove everywhere, always in his car, and he always drove. And I never felt fearful that we would have a wreck or anything, even though he was drinking. In fact, I used to tease him about how slow he was driving. I'd say, hey, we just got passed by a bread truck in that lane right there, the slow lane. But yeah, and I think he loved it. He liked it, because I wasn't stupid, so he liked it. Somebody with some intelligence would give him a hard time, and I thoroughly enjoyed giving him a hard time, as he enjoyed giving me a hard time. But
can you tell me more about your work in the Gulf, and you know what the fisheries were like back then?
There were more shrimp probably than there are now. And we did we caught a lot of red snapper. What were the fisheries like? I don't know exactly how to answer that.
What were some of the other discoveries that you were making out there?
Well, let's see. I think the interesting things I've pretty much gone over. We did, in addition to the regular work we did a lot of work with aquariums around the state. They would come down and we'd go out and catch fish and keep them in the live bait, and then they'd take them back to their aquarium. We did that for San Antonio Zoo, Breckenridge Aquarium. And I remember spent a lot of time with a guy from the Dallas Aquarium. In fact, he gave me a ride to Dallas when he was taking the fish back. And then they used to have a place in Galveston called, what was it called, Ciarama? No. It was way before the Moody. It was right up near where the golf course is up there. And but we did a lot of work with them. And in fact, I met someone, or two people, that they got met and got married working there, and they were divers, and they would dive into the aquarium and feed the fish and stuff. And so it was interesting talking to them and comparing notes. But we did a lot of work with them. One time, at least once, the manager of that aquarium went out with us in the Gulf off of Galveston. And he and I hit it off, and we brought them a lot of stuff back. So we did a lot of that kind of thing, really. And did a lot of work at night. And we did some work in bad weather, inclement weather. Austin always seemed to figure out that we ought to go out there when the weather was bad. Of course, they never would. But I remember one year, CE and I were working on it, and a blue norther blew in, and they wanted us to go out and pull trawls and see if we could catch a flounder that the norther may have been pushing out of the bay into the Gulf. So there we go, and we're the captain's keeping it face into the wind, and we're bouncing around, and CE says, and he points, and I look, and the air conditioning unit on top of the boat is on fire. Flames are, so I grab a fire extinguisher, and CE and I climb up, both of us up to the top, and water's, you know, cascading over us. I don't know how that fire kept going, but it did. And so we got there, and I held that fire extinguisher and aimed at that fire and squeezed the trigger, and it came off in my hand. And shortly after that, the fire went out. So we climbed back down best we could, and I asked our deckhand, the great cook, and about it, and he said he just turned the power off to the air conditioner, and that did the trick. I told CE later, I said, there's four of us that work on this boat. Two of us got college degrees, and one without the college degree, without much education at all, knew enough to how to turn that fire off. Not the college boys. So the lesson I learned there and have carried with me is that book learning's great, but it ain't everything. Sometimes you got to have street smarts to solve problems and accomplish things. Mm. Well,
How long did you work for Texas Parks and Wildlife?
About 15 years.
Okay. What did you do after?
Oh, man. After I opened up a Montgomery Ward catalog store, which I only ran for about a year, I didn't like that at all. So I sold it. And then I got a job with the newspaper, the local newspaper, writing. I wrote articles, wrote columns. They let me write a column. They put my picture in there and I'd write a column, whatever, anything I wanted. And then I did news. But on my column, I wrote poetry. I wrote short stories. You know, I wrote anything I wanted to, and they were fine with it, no problem. And then I did all the darkroom work for the paper. Did the where I learned to do that, I have no idea, but I did. And so I worked for them for 2 or 3 years. And then the wife of a guy who also worked there, the guy she worked, she was the wife of, was a manager of a radio station, a country western radio station. And they asked me to come try out to do the news. So I did, and I got the job. And so we were transmitting the news out of Sinton, and then they built a new studio in Corpus in one of the outlet malls there, not an outlet mall, but anyway, on SPID. And so that's where we did it from there. And that was probably the most fun job I ever had. I did the early morning news, and the station ran for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I was the only guy that used his real name. Ed Bradley did the news, nobody else. We had Hollywood Kelly and Joe Dragon, and you know. But that was a fun job. I won a dollar off of the disc jockey that I worked with. I won a dollar one time by doing the news with a paper bag over my head. And I got it. I won. But that was a lot of fun. But that lasted 2 or 3 years, too.
And why did you leave Parks and Wildlife?
I got a little mad at them. I guess I was kind of like my mother. You rubbed me the wrong way. I won't hit you, but I won't stay around long either. And I was always having trouble with them. On those trips that I had to go to Galveston every month, well, there's two ways you can go. You can go a short way where you drive up the island to get there, or the long way where you go around and go across the causeway. But if you take the short way up the island, the Parks and Wildlife charged a toll. You had to pay a toll at a certain point. And I said, well, I work for you guys. It doesn't matter. You got to pay the toll. So I would pay the toll. Well, when you used your car, you got mileage for it. They paid you mileage. So I would put that in there. And then I would also put in that I should be reimbursed for paying the toll. They had two arguments. One, if I went the long way, that was too many miles. If I went the short way, they weren't going to pay that toll. I weren't going to pay that. And we went around and around over that. I don't think I ever won. But I have found in the last few years that they don't charge employees the toll anymore. So maybe I had some effect. I don't know. But stuff like that was always going on. And finally, I just said, that's enough. All right, that's enough for me. So, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a great job. And they're very interesting and a lot to do. People used to say, "Wow, you're a marine biologist. That must be fun, exciting." So yeah, come out with me in the summertime when we're pulling a net through a small pool and you got mosquitoes and alligators and stuff after you. Come out then, see what you think. But it was great. Oh, there's another guy I probably ought to tell you about. His name was John Smith, and he was a non-game biologist. And he's another guy had about 20 acres there. And he once told me that he wouldn't plant anything on his property that he couldn't eat. No, he didn't care about flowers. He wanted fruit or something that he could eat, vegetables. And he was telling me one time, he was showing me where some of the bald eagle nests were, because he kept track of that. But he also kept track of crocodiles, and he was telling me that a guy with Fish and Wildlife would come down, and the two of them would go out at night, and he said the way you count them is you shine a light around, you count the eyes that you see, and then divide by two. And that's how many crocodiles there are. But he said they'd come in all wet and muddy and stuff. They'd check into a motel, and he said they'd sign in John Smith and Daniel Boone. He said people wouldn't believe it, but that was our name. That was our real names, John Smith and Daniel Boone. So
after the radio, then what did you do?
Well, when I was in high school, I had worked for a jeweler named Joe Salem. And he had a jewelry store in Six Points. And so I would work every Saturday and sometimes in the afternoons during the week, but mostly just on Saturdays. And I liked Joe Salem. He was a real character. I don't know if you ever heard of Salem's Jewelers, but anyway, I was going through the Pottery Staples Mall. Is it still there, the Pottery Staples Mall? Do they call it that anymore?
I think it's
La Palmas or something.
Yeah, La Palmera.
Anyway, yeah. Back then it was Pottery Staples Mall, and there was Salem's Jewelers in there. So I went in, was talking to him, and he offered me a job to manage that store for him. So I took it. So I worked there, opened up in the morning, opened the safe, put everything out. And then in the evenings, he would come, like 5 or 6 in the evenings, and he would come and I would leave and he'd put everything back in the safe. And we did that for about 3 years, I guess. And then I had a good buddy. I was good friends with he and his wife, and he called me one time, and at that time he was working for the Caller Times, just being a distributor. And so he distributed to stores, and then the stores would sell the papers. And he told me there was a distributorship coming open, and I could make pretty good money if I was interested. So I said, yeah, sure, I'll go interview with him. And I interviewed with him and I got it. And so then I had to buy me a pickup. And I worked for there at that for about 9 years. And that's where I was working on that suit.
Mm-hmm. How did you two meet?
Yeah, we had a mutual friend. This mutual friend had gone to the church or was going to the church that I went to. And before that, she had gone to the church that Sue went, was going to. So at some point, she said, told us both, I guess, that y'all need to get together. Y'all just need to get together. And eventually we did. And we dated for 11 and a half years before we got married. I used to tell my friends that whenever I got the urge to get married, I'd lay down on the couch for half an hour and it'd go away. And, but anyway, it's been great. So we've been married for a little over 20 years now. We got married in 2000.
Yes.
Yeah. 21 years. Okay, well, it'll come to me. But anyway, it's been great.
Great. Did you ever miss the marine biology stuff?
Well, sure. Yes, that's why I wanted to go by heart visit with them, because I had heard about the building and the programs, but I'd never been there. So we celebrated my birthday by going down and getting to see it and visit with some people. And yeah, that was, I do miss that, yes. I've always liked science. That particular type of science just always appealed to me. I have no interest in freshwater, just saltwater. And really not too much in the bays. I like it out in the Gulf. I guess I fell in love with it out there. It's amazing. I've been diving on the rigs out there when the water was so clear you could see all the way across the bottom of those rigs. It's amazing. It's beautiful. But you know, I never have seen a shark underwater. I've never seen one. I've done a lot of underwater diving, but I never saw a shark. And that's amazing.
I also wanted to ask, what was the university like back then?
Well, it was a Baptist school. And expensive. But it was, there were a lot of great people there, great kids. I remember, maybe I shouldn't tell this, but I'm going to. The president of the university, we had a get together every day. The whole student body had to meet. He got up there and he had a bowl of water in front of him. And he was complaining that people were using too many paper towels. So he gets his hand wet in this bowl of water and then he takes out two paper towels and dries his hands. And he says, you see, two at the most is all you need to dry your hands. And he put, and then he goes on with whatever else he's doing. But while he's talking about something else and not paying any attention, he reaches in his back pocket, pulls out a white handkerchief, and wipes his hands some more. And I said, I got you, buddy. And I'll never forget that either. I couldn't tell you what his name is, but I remember that incident. It wasn't a huge school. It was a small school, but we had a great, my department had a great professor. That Hildebrand was well known. And I don't have any doubt that his recommendation is what what got me in with Parks and Wildlife, and probably also got me in with the guy going to Bahamas. If he'd gotten the gig, I'm sure Dr. Hildebrand was behind all of that. And I liked Hildy. One of the things I remember the most is his final exams. They were 3 hours, solid writing. It was not 2 hours, or not 2.5 hours. It was 3 hours, and you're writing and writing and writing and writing. But I did okay. I made A's in all his classes, so I guess I impressed him. But they had a basketball team. They had a football team. I think that was all basketball and football they played. They weren't any good, of course. But and back then, Texas A&I and Kingsville, they were really good. And of course, we played them every year. Never at our place. We always had to go and play them at their place. And I was dating one of the cheerleaders at the time. And the week before UCC was going to go over to play Texas A&I, they decided that they wanted to go play a prank on A&I. So naturally, I was the one going to drive them over there. So I drove these, however many, 4 or 5 girls over to A&I to the football field. And then they climbed the fence or got under it or somehow. And on the football field, they put it's supposed to come up a different color green. UCC on their football field. And we thought that was hilarious. That was going to be great. Of course, it didn't work. Never panned out. But the idea, the idea was there. And I had fun doing that. But there was... So, I had a car of sorts, a 49 Pontiac. It ran good, but I didn't have any spares, so you had to make do with what you could. But I had 2 or 3 guys regularly that I would pick up in town and drive out to UCC to go to classes, and then everybody would be done about noon every day, so I would drive them home, and then I would go to work. I worked at a place called Gulf Iron Works. I don't think it's there anymore, but I worked every day from about 1 to 5 or 6 every day. So I made pretty good money. I didn't have to get a loan or anything to pay for my schooling. Plus, I was able to help Mom pay groceries and pay on the house where we lived. So I was fortunate there that I was able to help my friends and help my mom and do some things.
What was it like going back on your birthday and seeing the university?
It was interesting. It's very different. I was trying to find the building that used to be our lab building, but I didn't see it. I'm sure they must have torn it down. I had been there when the library was there, but most everything else is gone.
And the library was in the round building?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I had to get and do some business there when I was coming up here to go to school. I had to get main office was in there for some reason. I remember when we would register for school, when I was in school, everybody would set up in the field house, and all the professors would have tables, and they'd be sitting on their chair, and you'd go by and physically register for their class, and if there were too many on there, you too bad, buddy. And I mean, nowadays it's of course all online, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm glad I don't have to sit there.
But everybody had to be out there and do it the hard way. But we didn't think anything of it. When you don't know any better, you don't think anything of it, you know? But if you had to go back to it, doing it that way now, then it would be a toughie.
Well, this is your oral history. Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about with your life or anything at all?
Well, I'd like to tell you a little bit about a friend of mine named David Rue. Now, I may get choked up doing this, but I will. When I was in the fifth grade, we moved across town in Corpus Christi, and there was a elementary school named Crosley Elementary, and we did drive by. It's still there, but there's not much there. Sue got a picture of the front of it now. But my class in the fifth grade was on the second floor. And I remember my first day, I went and looked out the window, and that was looking down at the sidewalk leading up to the front door of the school. And I see this crippled boy coming up the sidewalk, and he's got a satchel in his hand. And he's very crippled. And all of a sudden, he falls down, trips over something or falls down. Nobody helps him. He slowly gets up by himself, picks up that satchel, and comes into the school. I never forgot that. I have never forgotten that. Over time, we became best friends. He had cerebral palsy. He couldn't drive a car. He couldn't ride a horse, couldn't do much walking. And yet he got his bachelor's degree, he got his master's degree, he got his doctor's degree. He was became a licensed minister. He was the head librarian at two universities, Grand Canyon University is, back then it was Grand Canyon College. He did more traveling than I will ever travel. I remember one time we were talking on the phone, and he was telling me that they had asked him to preach the sunrise service on Easter Sunday on Rocky Top. And he said that he said he would. And I said, do the cars go all the way up there? He said, no, I don't believe they do. And I said, well, how are you going to get up there? He said, that's not my problem. That's their problem, to get me up there. And that's the way he looked at it. And he's the only person I've ever known that got not one, but two tickets, tickets for driving a golf cart on the freeway. And he got two tickets like that. But he said at the time his excuse was the only way he could get to church. So he drove the golf cart. And he wasn't that good a driver of golf carts. I don't know how many telephone, mail boxes he ran over and ran down. And in fact, that'd be a running gag with us. Every time we'd talk on the phone, I'd say, "Have you hit any mailboxes today?" And he'd laugh. He could laugh. That guy could make him laugh. And I thoroughly enjoyed making him laugh. And then a few years ago, he got cancer. And I talked to his brother. He was living in North Carolina then. And I talked to his brother, and he was telling me it's only going to be a few days. So I talked to David, and at some point I said, "I love you, man." And he said, "We've loved each other for a long time." And then he passed. Not right then, but a couple of days later. But we used to have the best times together. Why he and I don't know. And just like why Hank and I don't know. But maybe it's because I gave him trouble. I gave David plenty of trouble too. One thing that made me mad was people, even in his family, called him Pee-wee. And that made me mad. His name was David. And I straightened everybody out every chance I got. His name is David. But I remember there was one year he was teaching, part-time teacher, at one of the high schools in Corpus. Carroll, I think. And he was telling me that he was giving them the last day of school before Christmas, he was giving them a test. I said, "You are giving him a test the last..." "Yeah, but it's going to be a good deal. It's going to be a good deal." So when it was over with, I picked him up and I said, "How did that lousy test you gave go?" And he said, "Well, it didn't go so well." He said, "It was supposed to be, when you filled in all the blanks, it spelled out Merry Christmas, and he misspelled Christmas." So, but he was a funny guy, and he was a great guy.
Is this? Ready for a break?